A red cedar grows in the far corner of a lonesome cemetery in the small southeast Arkansas town of St. Charles.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Denise Parkinson.
Through drought, flood, wind, ice storm, and unto drought again, the tree remains.
Daughter of the White River, Depression-era treachery and vengeance in the Arkansas Delta, published by the History Press. This true life tale is about a Depression-era tragedy in the Arkansas Delta.
John Black planted a cedar tree on a summer night in 1934. He dug a hole in the rich Delta earth and planted the tree to mark the burial place of Helen Ruth Spence.
Daughter of the White River, treachery, vengeance, tragedy, and redemption in the Arkansas Delta, with Denise Parkinson on Arts and Letters.
John Black carried Helen Ruth Spence's lifeless body to a patch of ground miles away from the funeral home in the Arkansas County seat of DeWitt, Arkansas. He did this with the help of others, who waited with him until dark to enter the funeral home in stealth and spirit away the body lying within.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. In part one of this two-part series, Daughter of the White River, we'll be talking with Denise Parkinson about the stranger-than-fiction life of Helen Spence, so young and beautiful, even in death, Helen Spence, a so-called outlaw. We'll also hear excerpts from a recorded conversation with Helen Spence's childhood friend, L.C. Brown, recorded shortly before his death.
And why shouldn't she be an outlaw, being as she was of the river?
Beginning their flight.
For Helen Spence belonged to the river people.
Denise Parkinson, writer, journalist, and founder of the Hot Springs Area Community Garden Network. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this is, Denise, just what a story. I mean, when you sent me this book, I was just stunned. It's almost like you couldn't make this up. This is stranger than fiction. So let's start with the beginning. Tell us a little bit about Helen Spence.
Well, Helen Spence is, in many ways, a real-life Mattie Ross. She's a true grit girl. And because she's a river person, I think of the true grit as the causation of a pearl. So to me, she was like a pearl of great price.
Give us a little bit of her background. Where was she born?
Helen Spence was born in Clarendon on a houseboat in 1912. She had an older sister, a couple of years older, named Edie. And they lived on the houseboat with their father, Cicero Spence. Their mother passed away when Helen was an infant, and their father remarried a river woman named Ada.
And so what happened to her birth mother?
Well, according to the time frame, it could have been anything. We don't know how she died. You know, there was terrible flu epidemics in the teens. It took me a long time to track down her name. Her name was Ellen Wood, and she died when Helen was only a toddler. But I think Helen idolized and idealized her mother because apparently Helen inherited her mother's incredible beauty. Her mother had very blonde hair and blue eyes, and Helen was very dark-haired with dark eyes, but she was beautiful. And there was something about the way Helen held her mother in this kind of esteem that, as you'll find in her memoir, she talks about a Norse goddess, a beautiful blonde Norse goddess. I saw that as her talking about her mother. We do know that Ada, who was the girl's stepmother, was beloved by them and was not in any way a wicked stepmother. What little I could find about Ada reminded me of my great-grandmother who lived on the river. So I used some of my great-grandmother's patterns of speech when I was recreating scenes with Ada Spence.
And so at that time, I think it's kind of interesting that there was a whole community of people living on riverboats.
There were communities up and down the White River. Now, my area of research is Clarendon, which is where my family's houseboat was located, within sight of the National Historic Register Bridge that we are actually trying to save right now to be part of the Delta Trail. My family's houseboat was there for a century until about the time I was 6 years old when the Corps of Engineers generated water from the dam and washed it away, and we couldn't go back. And there were communities, multi-ethnic communities of houseboat families up and down the White River at the various bays and at the various log chutes and the areas up and down the river where they loaded the barges with rice or with timber.
And in terms of her family, I mean, these names are just great. Cicero is her father. He's somewhat of a character. Her sister's name was?
Edie, and she had contracted childhood polio, so she was actually paralyzed. She couldn't walk or she couldn't swim, but they cared for her on the houseboat. They had a wonderful life, and the fisheries were so abundant, and they did not go hungry. So they were very well cared for, and they made everything they needed, and they could sew. Helen could sew as well as she could shoot.
The title of the book is Daughter of the White River, so the White River is certainly a character in this. This story is as much about place as it is about people.
Absolutely. And one thing that I've noticed is that if you've ever spent any time on the White River, it's almost like, well, there's a saying in Arkansas County that the river gets in your blood.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to writer Denise Parkinson talk about her book, Daughter of the White River. Could you give us a little of the timeline? So Helen was born.
She was born in 1912. She went to school further down the river in St. Charles. So they had left Clarendon by the time she was a child. She was 6 years old when the White River iced over, a very intense time during 1918, which coincided with the flu epidemic. But the river people just went ice skating. So nothing really stopped them from having fun, and they really lived life in a beautiful way.
We take the burden of our earthly souls, put from your heart the claims of home and wife.
You have these phenomenal pictures in here, early on even, of Helen and her family. Where did you find those?
That's the most fascinating thing. When I befriended Mr. Brown, Elsie Brown, I was told of an old-timer from the White River who knew a lot about the White River, and I was seeking information on my family's history and my ancestry because there's really nothing in the history books about the houseboat culture, especially that here was a multi-ethnic culture that self-identified according to the river and according to nature, something bigger than themselves, which I see as very significant because they did not identify and self-segregate according to their ethnicity. So I looked up Mr. Brown in the phone book, and he opened this whole world for me.
My name is L.C. Brown. I was born in April 17, 1926, in Arkansas County at a little town called Van, Arkansas.
And we conducted interviews and became great friends for a period of about 6 years until he passed away in 2015.
In your descriptions of the riverboat, houseboat people, that they lived by a strict code, would you like to talk about that?
Well, it was called a code of the river. I had an uncle, Archie Brown. He lived on an old houseboat down on the bayous, and we was considered in that clan of people as river rats. And we had, I believe it was a cousin of my grandfather's that lived on the river too. So my dad was the only one that would venture out into the river bottoms.
Arkansas's White River is a spirited creature, prone to overreaching its banks. Before it was tamed by man-made monsters, titanic dams built during a wave of mid-20th century engineering, hardy settlers came pioneering from the British Isles and Europe, arriving in Arkansas's Eastern Territory to discover an Eden. Some settlers built houseboats using wide planks of native cypress, floating homes that sheltered families who worked and thrived and were rocked to sleep by the rhythm of the water.
Cicero had a daughter who was a little bit older than you, but she and you would play on the riverbank and sit and talk while your dads conducted their business, and her name was Helen Spence. Can you tell us about Helen Spence?
Yes. My dad would drive up on the river bank, and he'd get out of his old car and he'd load up his pipe, light it. Cicero would be down there along the river bank, and this went on all the time. Dad'd get out of the car, Cicero would pick up a Winchester and he'd shoot up at the top of the tree. And I'd tell my dad, I said, after a time or two, I said, "Dad," I said, "Mr. Spence shooting at you." He said, "No, he's not shooting at me. He's just telling me where his territory is." And he said, "I respect him for that." My dad's going down to the, walk down the old plank, muddy bank down to the houseboat, and him and Cicero would sit there and talk, and I would play with Helen along the river. And she was a little older than I was. And I can remember one time, and she had on a pair of some kind of old stockings.
The fishnet stockings?
Fishnet type stockings. And she told me, she said, "Looky here," and showed me that, and stuffed them old stockings down there below the knee with a couple of $100 bills. I could see them through the thing. And I said, "What are they for?" He said, "Well, Daddy gave them to me so he wouldn't lose them, and he knew nobody would take them away from me."
She was really nice and kind to you, like a big sister?
Oh, yeah, she was very kind. And when my dad, Mr. Spence, would get through their conversation and had a little nip of white lightning, they called it, Dad'd get up to leave, and he'd come up the plank, and Cicero would holler to him and say, "Lem, come back and see me anytime you want to." My dad said, "Cicero, I will." But he said, "You know, you're shooting as bad as your whiskey." That was a ritual they went through.
Helen, as L.C. Brown would put it, is basically the face of the river people. And when I met river people that knew of her or had actually known her, the elderlies that are still with us, the few, it's like Helen Spence just died yesterday. They don't see time in the same way, and they love her. And so I just grew to love her, too.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to writer Denise Parkinson talk about her book, Daughter of the White River, and about the life of Helen Spence. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Denise Parkinson as she talks about the mysterious life of Helen Spence. Talked a little bit previously about some of the river people. It's a multi-ethnic community. Give us a sense of the feel of this riverboat community, because we hear often about riverboat communities in the Delta, and we hear about them in other places. This is on a river. It's not a lake, or it's not moored to the ocean, right? Tell us the differences.
Well, you would have to go back to a time before any dams were built. So this was a time when the rivers were free-flowing, and there were descendants of Native Americans, and there were descendants of freed slaves. So these people all were involved with cutting timber and working the commercial fisheries. They fished and they hunted, and they were tour guides for what they called drylanders that would come to the river and pay for a tour, a fishing trip and whatnot. They did that for many, many, many generations. But the thing that I thought was so beautiful was the mussel shelling, because these freshwater pearls are absolutely gorgeous, and until the dams were built, they were quite plentiful. But when the dams went in upstream, the water temperature changed, as it does, being released from the base of the dam, and a lot of the native species of fish were wiped out. A lot of the mussel shells were wiped out.
Called Mother of Pearl Buttons.
Oh, there were beautiful button factories all up and down. There were some at Clarendon, there were some at Brinkley, there were some at Desark. I mean, these were sustainable manufacturing industries that the people in the area controlled. This was not a plantation system.
And the oblong pearls were called river tears. Right?
Yes, and Mr. Brown kept a pair of river tears, and he always said that two river tears pulled from the same shell is bad luck.
Elsie Brown's father was the sheriff, and Elsie told you a little bit about playing on the riverbank with Helen and meeting up with Helen's friend, John Black.
When Elsie and his father got to the Spence houseboat, Ada, Helen and Edie's stepmother, was outside washing clothes. She explained, "Helen is walking to the log chute with a friend. Elsie's dad gave him permission to go, so the boy dropped his pole and tore off toward the bluff. Coming around a bend, Elsie caught sight of Helen walking with a skinny, dark-haired boy. He gave a shout, and the two stopped and turned. It was John Black."
So this is kind of the unseen hero of this entire story. Tell us about John Black as a young boy. Their relationship is... they're friends, but it seems to be more than that.
Well, actually, the quote, "Haven't you ever had a buddy?" really applies, because that's how river people are. you can have a dear friend and they can be like an older brother to you without having any kind of designs on them. So I've seen John Black's headstone, and he was actually a little bit older. So I portrayed him as her buddy because that's what I was told he was. Once during lunch in the schoolyard, Elsie heard some older girls talking about Helen. These girls were known gossips. Their fathers owned big tracts of land and worked their tenants ragged. Helen, what does jump the broom mean?
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with Denise Parkinson about the true life story of Helen Spence and her book, Daughter of the White River.
Well, I guess you thought you were clever.
Elsie asks Helen, what does jump the broom mean? And this, of course, means she's going to get married. She graduates from ninth grade. And tell us about this very quick marriage that doesn't last.
Well, Buster Eaton, you can see him on the cover of the book. And he looks like he's got quite the attitude.
For everybody, he has a hat on. It looks like a river hat. His tie is tucked into this striped shirt, and he has this blunt cigarette sticking out of his mouth, not on one corner, but it's right sticking out of the front. And his arms are at his hips, so he's looking like he's looking for a fight.
I'm impressed with your bag of tricks, and I don't give a damn about your politics. I burn through boys a lot cooler than you.
Fight. She looks like demure and cute as you can imagine.
Absolutely. And you'll notice those white stockings are long johns.
Pretty dress. Though,
the
right?
Pretty dress that she made herself because she was the best seamstress in Arkansas County, according to everyone that knew her or knew of her. In fact, I kind of see her as the Coco Chanel of Arkansas.
Right.
She had such style.
Now don't go taking this too far. You know only the lonely wind up at that.
And so she apparently fell under the spell of Buster Eaton's swagger, but he turned out to be a moonshiner. And Helen had her high standards, and the marriage lasted only a short while. We don't know exactly how long they were married, but
maybe a couple months.
Less than a year.
Right.
But she came back to the river and moved back home with Cicero Spence and Ada and her sister Edie.
Right.
Because she did not want to be involved with someone who was a moonshiner.
Cause I ain't too impressed with your bag of tricks, and I don't give a damn about your politics. I burn through boys a lot cooler than you.
Throwing her arms around Edie's neck, Helen cried, I'll have no truck with bootleggers. The sisters hugged each other tight as Elsie looked away.
So she returns to the river, a magical place with its frog rains and river tears, its hard times, floods, droughts, and sudden violence.
One morning in December, Helen woke to the sound of voices outside her window. It was Cicero, her father, talking to a man about a fishing trip. "All right, Jack," she heard her father say. And then came sounds of boots scraping about on deck and the boat motor cranking up.
Heaven, here's a river on a sticky summer day. When you're a daughter of the Delta and the river's where you play. Miss Helen was the best of these, and now she's gone away. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
Helen hurried to dress and went into the kitchen, where Ada sat staring at the fire. Ada said they needed to take Cicero lunch she packed for him. When Helen asked about Edie, Ada replied, still gazing into the iron stove, We'll be back before she wakes up.
Raised up right on a houseboat, back before the Dust Bowl came. Helen left a mark on everyone who knew her name. They all recall her fondly, though she met her end in shame. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
As the two women paddled away from the houseboat, Helen wondered who Jack could be. But before Ada could reply, voices ahead sounded raised in anger.
Okay, so they hear these voices and they're a little bit concerned. Help me with where the voices are.
They're ahead up the river. You know, sound carries over the water. They were catching up to Cicero and Jack Worrells, who were in another boat together. Cicero's boat came into view.
When times got bad, they never saw decisions made in haste. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
The two men were standing on the boat arguing. The women watched as Cicero lost his balance and swayed toward the other man.
Let's listen as L.C. Brown recounts what happened to Cicero, Helen's father, and Ada, Helen's mother.
Her father and a guy named Jack Worrells and their mother, Helen's stepmother, all went on a fishing trip. Got into an argument. They probably were passing the jug around. They got in an argument, and Jack shot Cicero and throwed him overboard out of the boat.
The man's arm went out. There came a loud report, and Cicero sank to his knees.
Heaven is a cool brush arbor by the riverside, but they say Helen lost her way for good the day her daddy died.
The man looked over his shoulder and saw them. He motioned with a gun for them to come closer. As Helen and Ada watched in terror, the man shoved Cicero's body into the water as though it were a floating log. Then the man called Jack, reached over, and hauled Ada into the boat. Grabbing the oars from Helen, he pushed the boat away with his foot and turned to crank the motor. As Helen drifted downstream, paralyzed with fear, the two continued into the distance until the boat's wake disappeared.
And then he assaulted Helen's stepmother, beat her up.
Hours later, when some fishermen found her, the girl was still in shock.
Okay, so what a moment, right? We have this guy who's seemingly looking for something. It's money. And they have an argument. Jack Worrells shoots Cicero, throws him into the water, and he could have still been alive, and then grabs Ada to ask her to tell him where the money was. And what happens?
Oh, well, Ada was protecting Helen, and so basically she ended up sacrificing herself. Jack Worrells beat her to the extent that she was placed in the Memphis hospital, and she hung on for a while, but she died right before the trial. She died January 7th, 1931, of the injuries she sustained from the beating and the rape.
Heaven is a cool brush arbor by the riverside, but they say Helen lost her way for good the day her daddy died.
News of Cicero Spence's murder raced up and down the White River. The river people shook their heads at such a betrayal of hospitality, voices dropping to compare notes on what happened to poor Ada.
So you said that she was beaten nearly to death. Looks like she was raped.
Yes.
And she couldn't recover from these. Although Helen and Edie, they were able to visit her and spend time with her, weren't they?
That's from my research, that they had made a trip to where she was basically languishing in a semi-conscious state in the hospital at Memphis. And she died, well, a few weeks before Jack Worrells' murder trial. She died in the first week of January 1931, and his murder trial happened about 2.5 weeks later.
Soon her mama followed, but Miss Helen never cried. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with Denise Parkinson about the remarkable story of Helen Ruth Spence from her book, Daughter of the White River. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return as author Denise Parkinson talks about her book, Daughter of the White River, and Helen's confrontation with Jack Wirles, the killer of her father and mother.
River justice is the only kind I know to trust. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
The young man named Jack Wirles, had flown into a rage upon finding no buried coins, no wad of bills stuffed inside a mason jar hidden in some tree hollow. Unleashing the full measure of his wrath, he beat Ada nearly to death. Jack Wirles was quickly apprehended and was actually going to stand trial in DeWitt. Ada languished in the Memphis hospital for weeks while Helen and Edie kept a bedside vigil. When Ada began to slip away, a pair of distant cousins arrived by train all the way from Chickasaw, Oklahoma. They came to fetch Miss Edie, explaining to Helen as kindly as they could that Edie would have a proper home in Oklahoma. The sisters made their goodbyes, and Helen prepared to return to St. Charles, an orphan.
Heaven's in the hearts of those who miss you when you go.
So, may I ask, did they ever see each other again?
They wrote letters constantly because they did not see each other again, but they exchanged letters constantly. And after Helen was murdered, Edie came back from Oklahoma to the river, and she brought her new husband, and she also brought dozens and dozens of letters that Helen had written to her.
Let's listen as L.C. Brown explains the subsequent capture and trial of Jack Wirles.
So does that mean that your dad helped bring in Jack Wirles to the courthouse?
Yes, he brought him in. The river people brought him to St. Charles.
Uh-huh.
And my dad picked him up. He didn't really want to come, but I understood that he had no choice but come.
So the trial set for January 19th, 1931, at the Arkansas County Courthouse in DeWitt. It's just a few miles from St. Charles.
The day of the trial had finally come. Melting snow dotted the fields, and the breeze carried a scent of cedar, hinting at fall spring. Helen Spence stepped from a car surrounded by deputies and crossed DeWitt's crowded town square to the courthouse steps.
Helen made her way to town where the jury sat row by row.
For hours, Helen sat quietly in the front row of the gallery, listening to the testimony, her expression a blank. She wore the same red velvet suit and rabbit fur muff as she had at the reunion dance.
I love the rabbit fur muff and the velvet red suit. She must have been striking, sitting in a red dress at this trial.
And the jury, Helen stayed with the sheriff's wife while the trial was going on. And they went to the courthouse every day. And the final day of the hearing, when they was there in the courthouse, jury was out for a while and come back. Somebody made the remark outside that they was probably turned Jack Wirles loose.
The judge told Jack Wirles to stand while the jury received some instructions. It looked like a solid case, but then you never know.
And as you did in the story, you moved to L.C.'s perspective.
Because he was terrified.
He was terrified.
He was sitting on the witness stand, and Helen was down about the middle ways. I wasn't there. I was just going on what my father told me. My dad was at the courthouse. He wasn't in the courthouse. He was in the hallway. He come back in and sat down in the chair again, and the judge was going to get the foreman's jury to tell him what the verdict was. But before he could read the verdict, Helen just stepped outside, and she had, back in them days, women carried a, they call a muff, hung around their neck in front, and they could put the hand in. She just got up, stepped out, pulled out a pistol.
Before their eyes, she shot the man who laid her daddy low. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
A volley of gunshots sounded from inside the courthouse. One by one, the first floor windows of the courthouse slid up with a bang, and men and women began tumbling out. Sounds of furniture crashing and high-pitched shrieks erupted in the interior.
Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
And she just stepped out, and she was about 20, 25 feet, my dad said, from the witness stand, and she just took that pistol, shot him four times right in the chest, and just turned around and walked out the courtroom, and there was an old constable named Boyston that smoked an old crooked stem pipe. And Helen and river people didn't like him. He was an old constable in DeWitt and in part of the county. And he smoked an old pipe that was had a crooked stem. My dad smoked a pipe that had a straight stem, and they were both big guys. And they had to back to Helen when she walked out the courtroom. And evidently she was going to do some more justice. And she still had the gun in her hand. And when my dad turned around, she said, "Oh, Mr. Brown, I come out near shooting you. I thought you was Mr. Boyston." And as soon as you turned around, I saw the straight stem pipe. And said, I knew who it was.
She was Arkansas's own gun girl in a time of fickle fame. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
And when they took Helen into the room to question her, my dad went with them. And she was sitting at a table with a judge and prosecutor and two deputies. And they were trying to get the cylinder to open on the old pistol. And it was laying on the table. And one of the deputies picked it up and was trying to open up the cylinder on it. Helen just reached over and got it and said, "I'll show you how to do that." And my dad said they all ducked. And she just opened the gun and dumped two extra shells out, handed the gun back to him.
Heaven's in the hearts of those who smile to speak your name. Regardless of the pressman who would glorify your shame.
The New York Times picked up the story, blurting on its front page on January 20th, 1931, "Girl kills alleged slayer of father in court. Fires as Arkansas jury is about to get case." Drawing a pistol as the jury rose to decide the fate of the man on trial, Mrs. Ruth Spence Eaton, 18, shot and killed Jack Worlds. The only statement the girl would make after the shooting was, "He killed my daddy." She showed no remorse.
So there's an interesting turn of events, right? Because this is this beautiful girl sitting in her red outfit, stoically in the courtroom. But then they shift the way that they tell the story here a little bit. Girl kills alleged slayer of father in court. Fires as Arkansas jury is about to get the case. She showed no remorse. She becomes the villain.
She was Arkansas's own gun girl in a time of fickle fame. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
And they got her age wrong. She turned 18 in the following month.
I know they wanted to sell papers, but the way it just came down becomes a very interesting way of dealing with this case, because I understand why it would capture the attention of everybody. She's beautiful. But why do they portray her as the villain here?
Well, it was the beginning of just a big smear campaign that she was an outlaw.
A killer and an orphan waiting for the court to say if they'd rule for her release or keep her always locked away.
So at this point, it's 1930. The newspapers have already been down covering a drought. It's been pretty severe. There are hunger strikes in England, Arkansas. So this place is already on the map.
Yes.
And to add to it, this crazy story just heightens it, right? It just blows it out of the water.
Yes, because the reporters from the Associated Press were in Arkansas to cover what was called the England Food Riot. And England is a Delta town not far from where our story takes place. And the very first food riot of the Great Depression took place there just a few weeks before the Jack Worrell's trial. So Arkansas has that dubious distinction of having the first food riot, but certainly not the last.
So they're there. So it's an easy trek to camp out. And once they hear of this story, I would imagine they all flock to,
yes,
to the courthouse.
It was picked up through the AP wire, and we do have the mugshot. And she's incredibly beautiful. So that's what got people.
Was this the mugshot?
That's one of them.
Mm-hmm. Very pretty.
Perhaps the most accurate reportage comes in a passage in the Arkansas Gazette detailing Helen's characteristic unrelenting spunk of fearlessness shared by those brought up under the code of river justice. She laughed, telling of the flight of judge, jurors, lawyers, and spectators from the courtroom when she opened fire. She hopes to obtain her freedom, as she does not believe that she committed a crime. When the electric chair was mentioned, she laughed again.
When you talked about her infamous laugh.
She was laughing because she did not believe she had done anything wrong, and she was scoffing.
River justice is the only kind I know to trust. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
All right, so she is released into the custody of the sheriff and his wife while her case is sent to the grand jury. And this is a case of, what, first-degree murder of Jack Worrells.
Yes. Faced a charge of first-degree murder, according to the Gazette's report of January 22, 1931. 17-year-old courtroom slayer indicted by grand jury.
Well, at least they got the age right.
They got her name right.
A killer and an orphan waiting for the court to say if they'd rule for her release or keep her always locked away. Helen made an honest living in the little town cafe. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
They release her, basically, from custody, but they have her secluded, working as a waitress in this little diner.
She was let out on a bond. Eventually, I believe Governor Parnell pardoned her. But she was released out on a bond.
But you've got to imagine that they had to know, or maybe they just didn't, that everybody in the world would come by this diner to try and interview her, snap a picture with her, or just look at her because she's this larger-than-life figure.
Yes. This was a situation where she was famous or infamous, depending, And people would come from miles around to see the Arkansas Gun Girl, which is one of the many names. They called her the Swamp Angel. And, you know, they tagged her with all these different titles that she did not ask for. So the Rothenhofer time was interesting.
Released out on a bond.
But while she was waiting to for the justice system for her case to work its way through, and while she was waiting to actually be placed into confinement, she was working at a cafe.
Yes, it was called Rothenhofer's Cafe, which was right on the square. It was a triangle building that set in the court square in between some more buildings, and there was an upstairs apartment, and she lived upstairs with another lady, and they worked in a restaurant. And
what happened in this restaurant in DeWitt that really adds a lot of tragedy to the story? What happened?
There was a gentleman named Bohot. And he owned the old restaurant, or managed it. And Jim Bohot was his name. He was I can barely remember what he looked like. He's a big feller, a Greek looking guy. And he drove a big old car, had spare tires on the side of it. And he came on to Helen quite heavy. And then one day, they at the edge of town, right where road comes into Highway 1, little place of trees out there, they found Mr. Bohot shot in the car.
With his own gun?
With his own gun. Somebody said Helen shot him, which people knew what happened. He took her out and he thought he'd take liberties with her, and she had a different idea.
On our next episode of Arts and Letters, we continue the story of Helen Ruth Spence. Please join us for the conclusion of this Stranger Than Fiction episode. Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters, Becca Mancari. Mandy McBride.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe, and there's no sickness, toil, or danger.
the remarkable S.J. Tucker and her song, Girl from the River.
Heaven is a river on a sticky summer day. When you're a daughter of the Delta and the river's where you play. Miss Helen was the best of these, and now she's gone away. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul.
And a special thanks to Iris DeMent for so many of the songs that served as the backdrop for this episode.
Like a white star.
Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the episode. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Denise Parkinson for recovering this tale of tragedy and redemption in the Arkansas Delta. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Helen Ruth Spence. This from a story she wrote while she was imprisoned. Like a Norse goddess, she stood erect, face lifted and silent. Her demeanor, as she stood eagerly inhaling the salty sea breeze, expressed that of a small bird which has been temporarily released from captivity.
Into